won't necessarily be the last one, but also very challenging, because you've been hearing from all of my heroes, and now I have to come after them. So I'm not even going to attempt to stand up to their heights. What I'm going to do is just going to give you kind of a historical perspective of how we've used all the different techniques that you guys have been hearing about for the last 10 days to try to understand at the molecular level of one particular biological problem that to me has been a main theme of my research since my PhD, which is what are the structural basis of microdynamic instability. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start by introducing you the biological problem. Then I'm going to tell you about the structure of tubulin, and I'm going to go into some details, some technical details, because I think after the things that you learned today, you will be particularly prone to appreciate those details. And then I'm going to work towards the state where we are now, which is one of great confusion, where we got a spark and we have some major methodological problem to handle. And I'm going to put you some equations to confuse you and then show you some models to convince you that we are on the right track. But basically, we are now at a point where we're having to reinvent new things to be able to deal with a problem at hand. So this is an example where when you are fixed on solving a certain biological problem, you make use of all the techniques that are available to you, and eventually you may come against a wall and have to invent something yourself. So that's what I'm going to be covering today. So let me tell you about why microtubules are so fascinating. So this is something that I borrowed from Connie Ryder's website. She's a great cell biologist, and she does great optical microscopy. And what this is showing you is just the same cell taking a different stages through the process of mitosis. And you're looking only at two components in the cell. In green are fluorescently labeled microtubules, and in blue you have DNA. And what you see here is just after the onset of mitosis, you have the duplication of the centrosome, so you have two asters that are starting to separate, two asters of microtubules. And in the nucleus, the DNA has started to condense. And a little bit later, what has happened is that the two asters are really separating at the two ends of the cell. The chromosomes are fully condensed, and they're starting to be trapped by a microtubule end that have as a purpose to line them all up in metaphase in the center plane, so that then at a certain point a signal is triggered so that the two chromatids separate and the microtubules from each aster pull on them and take them to the opposite end of the cell. And then eventually cytokinesis will happen here and the cell will split in two. And every daughter cell will have an equivalent set of copied DNA. Okay, so the reason why I'm showing you all this is because through the whole of this process, the microtubules have to be extremely dynamic. That means that they are, each individual microtubule is growing and is shrinking. And overall, the whole of the microtubule cytoskeleton is suffering great restructuration. So here you see that the microtubules are changing both in size and in distribution through this process. So the microtubules are a very dynamic system. It's a polymer that is not just rigid. It's growing and it's shrinking. And in this particular process, the way this happens has to be very, very carefully choreographed. So to do this, the microtubules rely on a number of accessory proteins that are regulators that are going to control in time and in space when they grow and when they shrink. But actually, even during interphase, where the microtubules are supposed to be less dynamic, if you look at the, you know, at the end of the cell where you can actually visualize individual microtubules because it's thinner and the density is a little bit lower, this is what is happening to supposedly a state of the cell where the microtubule population is very stable. But still, at the individual level, you can see that the microtubules are constantly growing and shrinking in a way that seems to be kind of stochastic. Okay. Well, the interesting thing is that if you purify tubulin out of cells, and you have just tubulin and GCP, by itself, the microtubules will go through this process. So this is not caused by other proteins that can make break the microtubule or make it a shrink and then make it grow up. This can be done by tubulin by itself. And it has to do with the binding, the hydrolysis, and the exchange of GTP in the tubulin subunit. Okay. So this is just a cartoon to summarize that the process, particularly during mitosis, when dynamic is, microtubule dynamic is more important and more clear, there is many factors that are involved in regulating precisely both in time and space when microtubule grow and shrink. And they come from any point during the life of tubulin, both from the at the time when the folding is regulated, how much of each alpha and beta tubulin subunit you make, how much dimer you make, how much microtubules you nucleate and microtubule organizing centers, and whether the microtubules are stabilized by stabilizing factors like MAPs or are being broken down or depolymerized by destabilizing factors such as kinesin, cationin, or estatin, to mention some. Okay. So in my lab, we have a study some of these factors and how they affect microtubule instability, but all that I'm going to be telling you today has to do what tubulin is capable to do just by itself, okay, without that further regulation. So this is a cartoon of what a microtubule is like. What you see here are alpha-beta tubulin dimers. So here the beta tubulin will be blue and the alpha tubulin will be yellow. And in the structure of a microtubule, what you have is alpha-beta tubulin dimers that bind head to tail to make what we call protofilaments. And then there's about 13 of them that associate laterally in a polar fashion, so they're all pointing in the same direction, forming the microtubule wall. And you see that from one protofilament to the other, there's a little stagger, so that actually you go through a helical path as you move from one subunit to the other along the microtubule. This is how microtubules look like when they are photo hydrated and studied by the EM, so that you don't just see a cartoon. These are, in particular, microtubules that have been stabilized with tassel, and so they're non-dynamic in this case. But the structure is, to all extents, very similar to what you would get with the stable microtubules during the period in which they are either growing or, in any case, not shrinking. Okay. All right. So one of the things, what we started doing 10 years ago was to pursue the structure of tubulin by electron crystallography. And the idea was to use a special type of polymer that had been discovered in the 50s when biochemists that have just been able to purify tubulin went to the shells of chemicals, and they just strike kind of everything, throw it into the tubulin and see what it will make. And tubulin has such an incredible tendency to self-assemble that it will assemble in many different conditions, and depending on what you have put in the soup, it will make different things. One of the things, and they had just kind of, it was just a matter of curiosity, what can this make? But one of those structures turned out to be very useful for us. So in the presence of zinc, the protofilaments that normally associate in parallel making the microtubule associate actually in an anti-parallel fashion. And the way this happens, and this Andy Conger told me how to explain this so that people will understand it, is that normally you have protofilaments associated laterally and all going up. And in the process of zinc, they now interact like this. So the polarity has been completely broken in two directions. Now you have some protofilaments going up and some protofilaments going down, and you have some protofilaments that are facing you this way, the outside of my hand, and some that are facing you this way, the inside of my hand. Okay? So the result of this is you've lost the polarity, obviously, but also when the microtubules associate in a parallel fashion, they do it at an angle, so that after about the association of 13, you close this polymer. But in here, that kind of angle is reversed from one protofilament to the other. So you basically end up with something that is flat. It doesn't close, so it can keep growing. And if you use the right conditions, this actually can grow to a couple of microns in both directions. You can imagine this is now one single monolayer of protein that is highly organized in two directions. I would call that a two-dimensional crystal. Okay. It's a particularly suitable two-dimensional crystal to EM studies because it is not really a crystal. It's a polymer, meaning that you have incredibly large contacts from one subunit to the other, polymerization contact rather than tiny crystal contact. So this was actually a very stable, highly ordered structure to study by electron crystallography. So this is a technical slide. And maybe 2 weeks ago you wouldn't have been able to interpret this at all, but I'm hoping that today you can. So at least the people that were in the 2D practical. So what I'm showing you here is the extent of the data set. And here, what you're seeing is basically the data points as a function of both tilt axis and resolution. Resolution as you go out in radius and tilt axis as you move in angle. And there's some more details in here, but basically the idea is that this line that you see here is where we decided to call it quits, and this is the resolution we included in the reconstruction, 3.7 angstroms, and the data was collected up to 60 degree tilt. So some information here. This had a symmetry that was given by the organization of tubulins in the lattice, so, and I will not go into details in there. But in here, for instance, in the case of electron crystallography, we use phases from image data and we use amplitudes from electron diffraction. So our crystals were large enough that we could collect very good electron diffraction data. And we collected close to 100 patterns. Most of them were at 45 degree tilt. And these are some numbers that reflect the goodness of the data. And basically what they tell you is that diffraction, electron diffraction is far from being as free of noise as X-ray diffraction is. Okay. So these numbers will be significantly lower in X-ray diffraction. On the other hand, the image data, which included about 150 images, has really great phase residuals all the way to the resolution that we included. So even up to 4 angstroms, the phase residuals was below 40 degrees. So phases were generally much better than what you obtained by X-ray crystallography by more indirect methods. Okay. Now, I wanted to show you this because some people yesterday, we were talking about the continuity of lattice lines in Fourier space for 2D crystals. What I'm showing you here is diffraction information, so this just contains information on, that comes from electron diffraction patterns, which I'm showing you three planes within Fourier space. So this here is the equator, and this could just be an electron diffraction pattern that you take directly from the sample. These two are two planes that you never collect, okay? They show, they're perpendicular to the equator, and they basically show how the intensity in the direction perpendicular to the plane of the crystal is continuous. And you have obtained these lattice lines, if you want, by interpolation between your data points that you collected by cutting, you know, by sampling those lattice lines at different points in your electron diffraction pattern. But I wanted to show it to you because it shows both the nature of how continuous those lattice lines are, and also because in here you probably can see the effects of the missing form. So there's data in there that because we don't go beyond 60 angstroms cannot be seen. Okay. So if at any point you guys have any questions, please interrupt me. That's the whole purpose of doing this. All right. So again, this is one particular electron diffraction pattern. This one probably extends to only 3.5 angstroms, is what I had in the computer. But we have election dispersion patterns in these kind of cultures that go to much higher resolution. In particular, Hu Lin Lee, who was a postdoctoral fellow that came after me in the Downing Lab, collected an incredible set of diffraction patterns that was actually used in their refinement that really went well beyond 3 angstroms. So that's an example of diffraction. I don't show you any images because the images you will see are all, nothing at all. So the images were taken very, very close to focus with very low doses, and they were actually taken using spot scan imaging. So the only thing that you will see will be circles of illumination with absolutely no structure because of how close to focus the images were taken, because we were pursuing high resolution. But if you would take that image and put it in the optical diffractometer, you would get something that came very close to this. So they weren't that good. So when we combined the phases and the amplitudes from our data set, we got a map that looks like this. So this is a part of the raw density map without any refinement, and it's showing you some Alpha Helices and Dawn and some of the beta sheets. And I show this because it shows that a region that is very rich in aromatic residues, and the aromatic residues have very dramatic side chains that we could use as beacons for the tracing of the polypeptide chain. So at 3.7 angstroms, we could actually trace the polypeptide chain in both of units that had about half of the sequence in beta sheet, something that had not been done before. Okay, so this is the structure of the tubulin subunit. This is beta tubulin. And at this point, I have to remember to tell you that all the data that went into producing this three-dimensional structure have been collected after stabilizing the 2D crystal with packs. This requires a special mention because many people were interested in the structure of tubulin, but there were some that were particularly interested because Taxol was bound to it. So Taxol is an anti-cancer drug. It's actually something that works and is broadly used, and it gets a lot of money in revenues. It's used for mostly for ovarian cancer. And the way it acts is a microtubule stabilizer. So it binds to tubulin and eliminates dynamic instability. So when the cells get to metaphase, and then they cannot divide because the microtubules need to shrink to pull the chromatids apart, and they cannot do it. Okay, so that's an effect that will be most dramatic in cells that are dividing very fast. Those are cancer cells. Okay, so what we found was that we could add Taxol to a two-dimensional crystal, and it had exactly the same effect that it had on microtubules. It made them resistant to cold temperature, and it made them basically resistant to aging with time. So it was perfect for our purposes of having very stable 2D crystals, but it also meant that when we obtained the structure, we obtained the binding site for this drug. Okay, so this is the structure of the beta subunit, which is the one that binds Taxol. And it's very compact. It has dimensions that are approximately 40 by 65 by 60 angstroms in the direction down the screen. And it's made up of mainly three domains. There's a nucleotide binding domain that is, there's a Rossmann fold that is used for binding nucleotides. It has seven beta strands that alternate with alpha helices. So basically you go up a beta strand and down an alpha helix, and you kind of thread your way around the nucleotide. And each of the loops that connect the beta strand to the alpha helix is involved in binding the nucleotide. I go into that into a little bit more detail. So then you get out of this domain into this helix, which we call H7 or central helix, into the second domain, which you will see is very important for lateral contacts and is also involved in the binding of Taxol. And then at the very end of that, you have two alpha helices, two antiparallel alpha helices that finish the structure, what we call the C-terminal domain. So it turned out when we got the structure, it was obtained at the same time as FTSZ was obtained by X-ray crystallography by Jan Luwe at the MRC in Linda Emerson's lab. And that turned out to be the structural homologue of tubulin. Tubulin doesn't have any homologue really known today in eukaryotes, but it has a homologue in bacteria, and that's FTSZ. And the thing that FTSZ is missing is actually these two C-terminal helices Those don't exist in FTSC. And you'll see later that those helices are the ones that stay to the outside of the microtubule and are involved in most of the interaction with associated microtubule proteins, particularly motors. Okay, so the good thing about having this structure was not only that we have the structure of the tubulin subunit, we have the structure of the diamond, we actually have the structure of the whole protofilament. That meant that we had direct information on how the contact of subunit between the dimers in the monomer and between polymer, between the dimers which are made during polymerization occur. And one of the things that we could see by comparing the nucleotide site in this position and in this position was that while the residues involved directly in binding the nucleotide in this subunit were conserved, the ones that come from the next subunit are only partially conserved. And one of those residues we propose to be involved in the hydrolysis of GTP. So one of the things that is essential and has been known for a long time about how dynamic instability comes along is that only, so we knew for a long time that there were two nucleotides in the alpha-beta tubulin subunit. But one was bound non-exchangeably to the alpha subunit and the other one bind exchangeably to the beta subunit. Looking at the structure, this is very obvious now. This nucleotide is completely buried at the monomer-monomer interface within the dimer. But in the dimer, this one in the beta subunit is exposed, so it can actually exchange with the surrounding. Now, you need this nucleotide to be GTP in order for tubulin to be able to polymerize. But after polymerization, that nucleotide is hydrolyzed, and that was a big mystery. How does that get hydrolyzed? And immediately after hydrolysis become non-exchangeable. Because now having GTP in the body of the microtubule is what is going to end up triggering microtubule disassembly. So what happens is when this polymerization interface is formed, there are nucleotides that come from the alpha subunit that interact with the nucleotide at this binding pocket and cause the hydrolysis. And in fact, during the formation of the 2D crystals, we started with GTP and we end up with GDP in this subunit. So just by looking at this protofilament, we could tell why in the dimer there are different exchangeabilities for the nucleotide, why this one gets hydrolyzed, and then why at that point it becomes non-exchangeable. Just directly from looking at this. Okay, so just quickly, all those loops that you see here colored in different, with different colors going from T1 to T6 are the loops in this Rossmann fold that are involved in binding the nucleotide. And then this T7 is the one that comes from the subunit above that contributes to this binding, and in particular for the alpha subunit will contribute to the hydrolysis of the nucleotide. And that's the residue that we think is involved in that hydrolysis. Now, so it was great to have the structure of the protofilament, but I told you that the lateral contact of between protofilaments in this type of polymer really had nothing to do with the contacts that occur in the microtubule. So in order to find out where were the polymerization interfaces that were involved in lateral contact, we teamed up with Ron Milligan, and in his lab they have obtained a structure of the microtubule at that point about 20 angstroms. Resolution that we could use to dock our structure of the protofilament and to find out what surfaces of that protofilament were now involved in lateral contact. So even at this resolution, the docking was very convincing and very unique. We could do it both by eye or we could do it by cross-correlation, letting the computer do the calculation. And we could take the protofilament as a whole and dock it by rotating around the protofilament axis, moving along the protofilament and getting in and out radially. And I hope that you can see that the docking is really good. Here you're just seeing a fragment of the wall, and here you're looking from the outside of the microtubule, and here you're looking down the microtubule axis. Okay. And so it was interesting to see that those C-terminal helices, as had been expected, form the crest of the protofilament on the outside surface, something that was, however, unexpected, was that the capsule binding site was actually on the inside of the microtubule. That's a long, still controversial story that I don't have time to tell you about. But the important thing is that this now defines what were the structural elements that were involved in that interaction. And those structural elements are a long loop in the second domain that we call the M loop or microtubule loop, and helices H3 and loop and the what we call the N terminal loop, a long not very well ordered in a structure loop in the N terminal domain. So this was actually very interesting because the contact was happening with one region here that was involved in binding tassel, which we know has effects on dynamic instability, and on this side with regions that were very much in a position to be able to read whether you had GTP or GBP in the structure. So this is another view of the nucleotide binding site, where you have the nucleotide here. This is the base, the sugar, and the phosphate. And the gamma phosphate will be here, and the T2 and T3 will basically be the equivalent of the switch 1 and switch 2 regions in classical GTPases, in switch type proteins that respond to hydrolysis of GTP with conformational changes. Okay. And interestingly enough, the two regions that are involved in the lateral contact directly follow those two regions of interaction with the nucleotide. So they were positioned in a way where they could respond, they could read whether there was a presence of the gamma phosphate here or not, and maybe transduce that information to the lateral interface to be able to control whether lateral interface occurs or not. Okay. So all that I showed you had been done with the initial model that was done without refinement by basically tracing the polypeptide chain on the raw density map. Since then, we included some more diffraction patterns that basically doubled the amount of diffraction data that we had, and those were collected by Huilin Lee in Kent Lab. And then we went through a process of refinement, which I did with the help of Jan Luger, the same person that obtained the structure of FTSC, where we used maximum likelihood by use phases in the target function. So we made use of the fact that we had very good experimental phases. We used constraint temperature factors because given the resolution of our structure, it made no sense to have variations in temperature factors changing very fast within our structure. And then another thing that was special for this refinement is that we used overall anisotropic temperature factors that took care of the fact that our data was worse in one direction, which was the direction of the missing cone, perpendicular to the plane of the structure. And we got a structure that refined to 3.5 angstrom, where we detected some errors in the initial models, very small, you know, three frameshifts of just one residue and some loops that were retraced, but basically the structure remained the same. However, the geometry of this structure is much better. So the PDB that corresponds to this refined structure is the one that people should use for docking and any other studies. Okay. I hope that you can see that this is the 2FO minus FC density map and the final model, and I hope that you can appreciate that both for alpha helices and beta sheets, the tracing is just very unique and very well defined. These are, of course, the average density. No, these are two very good regions of the map, but they generally were like this. Okay. So the final resolution, as I told you, is 3.5 angstroms, and the statistics of that refinement are actually extremely good. So this compares very nicely with X-ray structures at this type of resolution. Okay. And this is the structure. This is the beta subunit and the alpha subunit. And the differences between these and what I showed you before are very small. There are certain regions that we draw as loops before and now have become more clear alpha helices in the structure. But otherwise, the structure is just better geometrically, but basically the same. Okay. All right. So there were certain things that we were able to do after the refinement that we were not be able to do before. One of them was to detect ions, positive ions in the structure. Okay, so even at this resolution, something like magnesium could be seen because the positive charge makes a particularly strong interaction with electrons, so you get a very like extra large density map corresponding to the ion. And this is the magnesium that is present under non-exchangeable nucleotide binding site and is involved with binding to the gamma phosphate. Such a magnesium will also exist in the beta subunit if it was bound to GDP, but upon hydrolysis, you not only lose the inorganic phosphate, you also lose the magnesium. And these two acidic residues are the ones that are involved in binding that magnesium, and they are completely conserved, just like the rest of the residues involved in direct binding with the nucleotide at that site. The other thing that we could do is define very precisely all the elements, all the residues that are involved in binding the taxol molecule in the structure. And then something was, however, left behind. So when we did all this docking, the protein, the nucleotides, the magnesium ion, the taxol, there was still this density that remained. And this is basically what is left of the density that is not accounted for, even if you display a 5-sigma. So this is a beacon in the structure that appears right between the two between the two dimers at a lateral interface in the zinc sheet. And we interpreted this as being the zinc ion, the one that is modifying that interface to give rise to different type of polymers. And that density that we interpret as the zinc is surrounded by histidine, by two histidines and two glutamic acids, making something that very much looks like a zinc binding site. So these now explain why you have these structures in the presence of zinc. So this is the M loop that is normally involved in microtubule lateral interactions. And however, the presence of this zinc has now made it more energetically favorable to interact with another binding site that complements the interaction mediated through this zinc ion. Okay. So this is something that we only saw once we did the refinement. Okay, so something else that had happened since those initial experiments is that using single particle methodology rather than helical reconstruction method to study the microtubule, there is now a structure at much higher resolution. So this is, what you see here is a microtubule image that has been taken at 400 kiloelectron volts and taken very close to focus. So the image of the microtubule is faintly there, but the image has very high resolution. And what Huilin Li did in Ken's lab was to divide the microtubule up into small pieces and then align them with respect to one another using a modified idea from the single particle approach and SPIDER to align them both in plane and out of plane to get now a much an average fragment where the diffraction extends to basically better than 10 angstrom resolution. So now the structure that comes out of it, the microtubule now, this has this level of detail, okay? And if you cut the microtubule through a perpendicular section to the microtubule axis, I hope that you can see that some of those helices that make up the tubular structure are cut perpendicular to the axis, and you can see them very clearly separated. And in fact, if you look at the density and do the docking, you can dock the two structures, one helix at a time, because you see the helical rods corresponding to the alpha helices. And this now proved that basically the structure that we had obtained could be docked as a rigid body into the microtubule structure, really telling us that the structure in the zinc sheet and the microtubule are the same. There were very small differences, and one had to do with one of the helices that are close to the nucleotide binding site helix H6, which becomes partly disordered. And the other has to do with the conformation of the M loop. Okay, but otherwise the structures were the same. So this So that confirmed that the document that we had was correct, that the initially that these elements were involved in lateral contact, and for those that were very incredulous about taxol binding on the inside, it kept confirming that the taxol binding site is on the inside of the microtubule. And now this more precise docking was also used to characterize more carefully that lateral interaction in terms of how much hydrophobic versus electrostatic interaction is involved in this interface. Okay. So after that, everything worked very fine. That's the past recent and long time ago. And now, what are the things that we are still interested in and that we are struggling with? So we still haven't answered the final question of how dynamic instability comes by. So I told you that we know all of these things, and we can explain many of them up to a certain point, like how hydrolysis occurs upon polymerization. But what we have been known for a while and was most clearly demonstrated in 1891 by Ron Milligan and the Mandelkops by trapping microtubules in the process of depolymerizing by cryo-EM, so that the depolymerization of microtubules really happens from the end at the end, and that involves a transition from a straight to a curved conformation that brings about the separation of the protofilament and the curling of this protofilament. And these are images where we use divine and cations so that these breakdown patterns are stabilized, if you can see them for a little bit longer. But eventually, what happens in the cell is that these curved pieces break down into dimers, where now the GDP can be exchanged by GTP, and those subunits can now be recycled to go back and polymerize microtubules. So the final question that we want to ask is, okay, in here we have tubulin that is in a GDP state. However, our idea is that while it is in the microtubule structure, it is constrained. So it hydrolyzes the GTP, and the energy of hydrolysis is kind of stored in a strain. And the tubulin wants to change conformation, but it can't because it's surrounded by all these neighbors that are keeping it trapped. And that the microtubule remains stable as long as there are GTP-containing subunits at the end of the microtubule. That's called the GTP cap hypothesis. The idea is that while you have GTP at the very end, most likely the lateral contacts are holding the microtubule together at that end. But when hydrolysis occurs at this end of the microtubule, those lateral contacts get released, and now the conformational change from the straight to the curve can happen. And this is the result of this losing that GTP cap. So what we're interested in knowing is what exactly happens at that point. The macro effect in the protofilament is very obvious, but how does this come about from the tubulin subunit? Is this just happening by kinking at tubulin dimer interfaces? Do this curve be originated from one monomer to the other? Does the structure of the monomer itself change? So we wanted to pursue that, and initially what we did was to form these kind of structures starting from GDP subunit in the process of divalent cations and try to use single particle methodology to study them. So this was that. So look at this image. This was actually taken with the same microscope that was used for obtaining the tubulin structure from the same sheet. So this is a microscope that is high resolution by low contrast, and there are rings in there, but they're hard to see. So the people from the back, even with these boxes, will not be able to see them. So those are the rings that we wanted to study by single particle averaging to get a structure of tubulin in this curved conformation. And we couldn't go much farther than generating projections with class averages in 2D that contain about 30 rings, because these rings are incredibly flexible. They come in different sizes. They come as single, double, triples. They come as spirals. So just by doing this step of analysis, the only thing that we could tell is that it seems like each protofilament was organized in such a way that the bumpy side of the protofilament, which in the microtubule faces the lumen, the inside of the microtubule, is now on the outside, while the flat surface that is made up by these C-terminal helices now makes the inside of the ring, telling us that the way these depolymerize is by curving inside out in a radial fashion. Okay. So there's just a very rough model that in the straight protofilament you have the dimers going like this, and in the curved protofilament the dimer is the orientation is like that. The curvature occurs approximately in this direction. But this is a model. This is assuming that there's no change in the tubulin monomer and that you're kinking at every alpha-beta tubulin subunit. So in order to really get a direct information of these rings would not work, but what we have been able to do, were able to do almost 2 years ago, was to grow those TDP tubulin structures into something that is basically a helical crystal. Okay. In here, what you're looking at is actually two protofilaments, one inside the other, that curves around in a very, very tight coil. And a diffraction pattern from this one particular tube, this is a diameter of about 500 angstroms, gives you diffraction that goes well beyond 20 angstroms. So this is a Fourier transform when the first year of the CTF is here, and you see very clear diffraction after that first year at about 17 angstrom resolution. Okay. Now the problem that we have with these structures is that, as I told you, there are two protofilaments, one inside the other. And that is very good to make this rigid and to probably give a stability to the structure. But it makes the image analysis hell. Okay. So this is an attempt to index in the pattern where our main conclusion is the lattice lines coming from the inner and outer layers of those helices superimposed. So what is the idea? The idea is that in both the inner and outer surface, you have exactly the same packing of the tubulin subunit. So this will be a protofilament, and then this is the tube that has been opened, and you're just looking at a 2D as a radial projection. Probably you covered that. There was here. Mention it. Okay. So basically, what we're seeing is something where you go along a protofilament, and then you come back, and you have made a full turn, and you move back up one subunit. So that's also what is called a genetic helix. So that is what is happening here, but it's happening with two different radii. So you have exactly the same arrangement of subunits, but one is going around the outer surface, and the other one is going around the inner surface. And what this means is that you have a superposition for each line of Bessel functions that of two different orders, one coming from the inner and one coming from the outer layer. So normally, people face the problem of layer line superposition at very high resolutions when they already know a lot about the structure at lower resolutions. But in our case, this happens basically for every single layer line, for all the layer lines. So the idea in helical reconstruction methodology is that if you don't have Bessel order superposition, if you just take one image so that you have one plane in the Fourier transform of your helix, you basically know the whole Fourier space once you index your pattern, because every layer line will be made by one Bessel order function where the intensity, the amplitude is constant around the axis. So as you move in angle at a fixed radius. And the phase variation is just given by the order of the Bessel function. Okay, so you go through as many periods as the Bessel order function. So it means you take one single image from your helix and you know the whole of Fourier space. It means you then you can just do a Fourier transform and recover your structure. It's great. However, if you have two layers and you have superposition of these layer lines such that the two Bessel orders are superimposing and are doing it in such a way that the amplitude is now not conserved, is not the same along the when you move angularly, then having one plane of the image doesn't tell you what the rest of the structure is like. Okay, what the rest of Fourier transform is like. So so basically this what this means is that any point in Fourier space is made up by two components, two big G's of the ones that David Desrosiers told you about, one corresponding to the inner layer and one corresponding to the outer layer, where there is a phase relationship that is actually not included here that has to do with the two layers maybe not starting at this, not having exactly the same phase and azimuthal origin. Okay, so that cannot be done. We have to find another way of doing this. Okay, so the main problem for us, we could know how the Fourier transform actually changes when you move in Fourier space if we knew what is the spatial relationship between the two, the inner and outer helix. If we knew whether they start at the same point or whether one is higher than the other or whether one starts here and the other one starts here. If we knew those parameters, which are called phi and z in our structure, then having that relationship will allow us to interpret the what happens in Fourier space. But how can we obtain those parameters? Okay. So this is just to let you know that those two, the inner and outer, are related through the big G's for the inner and outer with a phase that depends on the relative phase and z origin. So just if you have your two helices, are they in plane or are they one displaced with respect to the other in height? Or do they start at the same point or does one start after the other? That's kind of the relationship. If we knew that and then we knew the order of both of them, the lattice parameters for both of them, then we could solve this problem. So, I don't know whether I want to go through this. So the idea is that if we collect many images of those tubes, and the images are going to be in different orientation, if we could put those together, if we could align one with respect to the other, because we knew the relative phi and z values both for the inner and outer from one tube to the next, then we would be able to basically collect the information on all Fourier space and being able to align it and then do an inverse Fourier transform and go through the whole process. But, you know, we, in order to just do it by solving normal equations that come from doing this for all of our images, we would have to have these values very accurately. And we have a way of getting initial values that I'm going to mention in a second, which is back projection, as many of you may have already thought. But they are not accurate enough that we will converge to the right answer in here. So we've taken another alternative, which is an iterative method where we assume a certain value for these parameters, these orientational parameters for the inner and outer helix. And then assuming that we get the values for the G in and G out, that allows us to generate a 3D structure to which we can align our experimental images to get better estimates of those orientational parameters and go through the process until it basically converges. Okay? And the idea to do that is that if we have the idea to be able to exploit this, I know this is getting heavy towards the end, but if you thought that you could get away with that equation, it's just wrong. So the idea is that if we take one layer line that has two components, one from the inner and one from the outer, but we disregard the outer, we just assume that it has the orientational, we impose the orientational parameters for the inner and the Bessel order function for the inner. That means that when we average through all of the when we average over many images, basically all of the inner components, the components that belong to the inner surface, will add in phase, and what you will recover the average. While the others, the outer ones, because you've been imposing something that is incorrect, basically when you do it over a large enough number of images, they will be adding completely out of phase randomly and will cancel out. Okay? This is something that we can actually, is very similar to the method that is used when you have better order overlap at high resolution and you already have a structure that is more or less known at lower resolution, so you have good estimates of these values. And that's what Nigel did, for instance, for his acetylcholine receptor to move from 9 to 400 resolution. But in our case, we are doing it from the beginning, where these values can only be estimates, okay? So this is the way the algorithm that Hongwei Wang, the postdoc in my lab that is working on this, create. So he has the raw images, gets the Fourier transform, and from this spectra, he gets the line data, and he indexes it so as to get the helical parameters. And using the helical parameters, he uses back projection to recover the inner and outer densities and see how they relate to one another to get these orientational parameters between the inner and outer layer. And then he imposes those orientational parameters on the layer line, first assuming that the values correspond to the inner layer, and that gives him the average inner G, the big G for the inner surface. Or he does it imposing this orientational parameter that corresponds to the outer and get this average outer G. When you put these two together, you get a final reconstruction that now you can use basically to realign your data and go through this process in an iterative fashion. Okay. Now, how does he get these initial parameters between the inner and outer layer? So he uses back projection methodology, and this has been used for helical structures that are not perfect in the past, and for instance, Ron used it to get a structure of the microtubule when Hernando Sosa in his lab did that kind of work. So the idea is that if you move along the, if you have one image of a helix, moving along the helix will correspond to taking images of that helix when it has been rotated by a certain amount. So in a way, if as you move, as you put, you can put together images of boxes moving along the helical structure, and if you know the helical parameters, you know how they will be related in angle, and it will be the equivalent of having done a tomograph. Okay. So the thing is, because you have two helices, you have two different helical parameters. And the idea was, if in here you impose the helical parameters for the outer helix will be recovered, but the inner will be completely smeared out. And if you do it imposing the helical, the parameters for the inner helix, you recover the inner helix and the outer one will be smeared out. And that's what happens. You do the reconstruction, you get this type of thing. And then you mask out the smears and you put together the two structures. And if you have kept good track of the phase origin for all of this, this is now going to give you how one structure relates to the other. It's going to give you the position of the inner versus the outer. And that's what you use as an initial value. Those values are not very precise because this is going to be a noisy reconstruction. It's not going to be a very precise value, but they are enough to start this process. So this has now been proven very well with models, and he is in the process of proving it with data. And so far, up to about 25 ounces of resolution seems to work well. But I'm not going to be showing you that because it's just too speculative at this moment. But these are models. Well, what he's done is he's taken the tubular structure. He just made a proper filament that curls around two layers and put them together and generate different projections. And he's been here as negative as possible. He's assumed that the orientation between the inner and outer layer doesn't even get conserved from one tube to the other, something that now working with the real data seems not to be the case. It seems that the two layers actually have a physical contact that is maintained from one to the other. But this is not even assuming here. So what he's done is with these images, he's generated a back projection, he's generated four back projections, and then four structured by back projections. He's averaged them, and then used that as a starting point to then go through a number of cycles in his program, and basically is using only up to 20 amps of resolution, but up to 20 amps of resolution by the third iteration, he's just basically recovered the structure that he put in. Okay. And this is shown here for both the inner and outer helices. Now, what was interesting is that he said, well, let's assume that these values were really, really wrong. Would the algorithm still converge? Let's assume completely random values for this first iteration. Not do the back projection. Just impose whatever relationship to start with. So to start with, you have something that looks completely wrong. But as you go through the iterative process, very quickly, it converges. Okay. So the algorithm is powerful enough that it doesn't matter where you start in the search space, it eventually will converge, and it seems to converge very quickly. How it may be that with real data that is noisier, the convergence may be slower, but up to that point, it seems to work. We want to believe that it works. So this is the kind of positive note within the conundrum that we are actually facing concerning how to make use of these beautiful crystals that, however, have this property that makes image reconstruction very difficult. And with this, I will finish. And just so the structure of tubulin was obtained when I was a postdoc in Ken Downey's lab, and Sharon Ward was also a postdoc contributing to that effort. Then the refinement, as I told you, included diffraction data from Huilin Li, who is now independent investigator at Brookhaven National Lab, and was with the help of a crystallographer, Jan Luber, who is at MRC. The initial docking on the microtubule was used using a structure that was generated in Ron's lab, and then this higher resolution structure was again obtained, as I said, by Huilin Li and David Dormissier helping during his sabbatical in Berkeley on developing the algorithm that he used. The initial studies on the rings were done by William Nicholson and Menu Li, and the work now on the helical cubes is being done by Paul Weidman. And thank them for doing it, and thank you for your attention. And you were very quiet, but please now ask me questions, otherwise I would think that everything went. That's what we think with the work that we have done now with the real data. So, right. So we tried, and the thing is, if that algorithm is extremely, it relies on having the right values for that orientational parameters. If you don't have them, it gives you the wrong answer. That's the bottom end. So you need something that doesn't assume those values and is able to generate to generate a structure that will be enough, good enough, to repeat the process now, allowing you better determination of those parameters and to cycle until it converges. The thing is, the reality is that if you don't know those parameters well, you have more incognito than equations. So there's no real way of solving it analytically. It has to be an approach where you just search a space through an iterative method. I completely agree. The method number one will work if those parameters were correct. So if at the end of the day we get a structure, we could go back, use those parameters, and solve it by that method. Okay. But right now, that is the best that we have been able to come up with. No. So we need incredibly accurate values. I mean, we've done that with our models. So you are wrong by a couple of degrees in the alignment. And things at the end, when you go back around the helix, you're completely off. You're off by half a monomer or something. That's it. It doesn't work. Tomography will not have enough resolution. So even when we do back projection, we have too much noise. Stenography will be even it will be even noisier. So when you impose the helical parameters for the inner, which means you have to go along so much to go up that much, you recover that, but the back projection algorithm will completely is smeared up the other thing. So then you go physically and mask the density that is smeared. Okay. No, it doesn't work. So ed program works particularly well where you have a helical structure, but you're not absolutely sure what the helical parameters are. So you assume a certain helical parameter. You do single particles, and you get a new value for those helical parameters that, if the algorithm was well, end up converging to the real value. That's not a problem. That is not a problem. It's a completely different story. Yeah, so they come in different families, and so the ones that are more abundant are the tubes that have 24 tubulin monomers on the inside and 32 on the outside, which were also the most common when you have closed rings, but also the most common in preparation. But we have also 30, so we have smaller and larger tubes. That are a bit more rare, and then in some cases we have a triple layer where there is one that is even smaller in the center or the other way around, but there's even triple layer. So when we have our images, we have to select for one particular family that is given by the diameter and the number of layers in the tube. The triple layers are particularly well ordered, so those are the ones that give the highest diffraction, and maybe because they're even more stable. So if this works, you just have to add one more parameter and make your number of equations a little bit larger, but the algorithm should work as well. So instead of searching for inner and outer G, you have inner, medium, and outer. So it will be a little bit more complex to go to that parameter space, but we should be able to do it also. If it works, we could eventually go back to those and get the structure from that, those also. But right now we concentrate on these because they're the most stable. Single layer tubes come very rarely, and they never are very, very big. And we've been able to produce them more abundantly when we have cryptophysin 1 bound to it, which is a tubulin depolymerizer. But in that case, the tubes tend to aggregate, so we have not been able to use it. Yeah, so if you want tax all, this will break down and make my tube. I think that these tubes, for us, are the equivalent of the thin sheet. It's all the structures where the conformation of the relaxed GDP conformation has been conserved along the protofilament. But when the protofilaments have interacted with one another, making a stable contact that have allowed for this to grow. So it's exactly I see that in the case of the thin sheet, you have the straight structure of the protofilament, and then you make something that is completely aberrant, which is a lateral contact that has allowed you to basically crystallize this in 2D. So here, this is a structure that we think is very similar to what you get when you depolymerize the microtubule. It has very similar radius, and we want to believe that very similar structure. But now, instead of just ending, we have made lateral contact stable enough that this can continue and somehow be stabilized by contact from one protofilament to the other into something that now is a one-dimensional bridge. We think that having those two layers is what makes these structures live longer and be able to grow. The third layer you can actually see coming. So there are tubes that are double, and when we froze it, the third layer was starting to form, and you can see it dropping, and it's still not finished in some of these structures. That's actually one that I went very fast, I double-clicked, but otherwise you haven't been able to see it. But I think the double is very hard for it to exist. So we haven't tried things like that. We've tried changing pH, salt concentration, things like that, and nothing has gone from the two to the one without actually ended up not having anything because the structures don't stay.
Is the curvature the same with
that? Okay, let me think about that. The estatmin one is maybe closer to the inner layer. The estatmin curvature in the crystal of the estatmin homolog tube is like this. Okay, so this, instead of being closed, is opened up like that, so that the peak is actually very similar to the diameter. That is actually something that looks very similar to the vinblastine tubulin. So when you add vinblastine to tubulin, it makes a spiral, and they have very similar dimensions to the stagnant. So I think all of those depolymerized form of tubulin, either is brought about or stabilized by a destabilized other drug, are going to be related. I just don't know whether they're going to be the same until we have a structure of one without them and we make